Ever since she was a little girl, Jody Huizentrout dreamed of stardom. From the first moment she set her eyes on the television, she wanted to be in front of the cameras, wanted to see her name in lights. As she aged, Jody's dreams began to take focus, and her interest shifted from Hollywood celebrity to journalism. And in a combination of the two, she pursued a career in television news. Throughout her 20s, Jody worked for several local television stations as a bureau chief and occasional on-air talent. However, what she truly desired was to anchor the news in a major market. Driven, determined, and hardworking, Jody would find herself as a producer for KIMT in Mason City, Iowa. A challenging job for sure, but it came with one major bonus. Jody would also anchor the morning and afternoon news broadcasts. Everything seemed to be falling into place. Jody was a celebrity within the small boundaries of Mason City, and while she was now doing what she'd always wanted, she couldn't help but long for a bigger market and a larger stage. Despite this, she enjoyed her time in Mason City, making friends, going out, and being the bubbly, socially proficient woman she'd always been. Unfortunately, celebrity, no matter how minor the scale, comes with as many risks as rewards. On June 27th, 1995, Jody was running late for her 3 a.m. start time. Her assistant called and woke her at approximately 4 a.m. Jody apologized for sleeping in, though this was hardly the first time, and said she'd be at the station in 20 minutes. Jody would never arrive, and when police did a welfare check, they found her car, surrounded by her own personal effects and obvious signs of a struggle, leading them to believe that the beautiful young reporter had been abducted. Over the course of the next 23 years, the search for Jody Huizentrout would lead down a dark path filled with the taunts of convicted sex offenders, accusations of corruption within Iowa law enforcement, suggestions of a political cover-up, and the rumors and speculation surrounding a rich socialite and his alleged designs on Jody. What happened to Jody Huizentrout, and where does the truth lie in this baffling mystery? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 46, The Abduction of Jody Huizentrout, Part 1. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. In today's episode, I examine the shocking abduction of KIMT reporter Jody Huizentrout in June of 1995. Before getting into the case, a few quick notes about the show. Trace Evidence is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and all your favorite podcatchers, so make sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. If you'd like to contact me to discuss the show or suggest a case, you can email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Trace Evidence is on Twitter at @traceevpod, Instagram at @traceevidencepod, and you can join the Facebook discussion group where I post frequent updates and discuss all subjects with listeners simply by opening Facebook and searching for Trace Evidence. You can find full episodes, transcripts, merchandise links, and much more on the website at trace-evidence.com. As a final note, Trace Evidence is a complete one-man operation, so if you'd like to help support the podcast, please visit the Patreon page at patreon.com/traceevidence, where you can gain rewards such as stickers, pins, and other exclusives. If Patreon isn't your thing and you still want to pitch in, I've added a PayPal donation button on the website. The abduction of Jody Huizentrout is one of the most complicated and baffling cases I've ever examined. The investigation spans 23 years and is filled with twists, turns, accusations, and denials. Due to the complexity of this case and the vast amount of information available, I've elected to split it into two parts for easier listening. This is episode 46, The Abduction of Jody Huzentrout, Part 1. Jody Sue Huzentrout was born on June 5, 1968, in Long Prairie, Minnesota, to Maurice and Imogene, often called Jane. Jody was Maurice and Jane's third daughter and would be their final child, having now filled out a family that spanned a wide age gap, with Joanne, the eldest, Jill, the middle child, and Jody as the baby. When Jody was born, her sister Joanne was already 18 years old. In a way, this put Joanne in a position where she often felt more like a parent to Jody than a sister. But regardless, their relationship was well-developed and exceedingly loving. Joanne would later describe Jody, stating, quote, "Jody had probably the greatest personality. I know she's my kid's sister, and I'm very proud of her, but she was so personable and bubbly. Everybody says that about her. There's a lot of pretty faces out there, but to have a personality like hers, it was very unique." End quote. Long Prairie is a small city in Todd County, with a population of just over 3,000 residents in a total of 2.67 square miles. The city was named after the Long Prairie River and is bordered on the south by Lake Charlotte. Housed at the junction of U.S. Highway 71, as well as State Highways 27 and 287, Long Prairie is a city built around the beauty of its natural surroundings, as well as recreational and leisure activities. The educational system revolves within the Long Prairie Gray Eagle Public School System, containing an elementary school and a secondary or high school, along with options for early childhood education. Suffice it to say, Long Prairie is a sleepy, calm town that, despite its designations, feels more like a small town than that of a city. Jody's early life was filled with joy and happiness. She was an active child, and in a sense, was almost a surrogate son for her father, who'd never had one, but secretly had always hoped for one. In that sense, Jody was the baby, and exceedingly close to her father, who introduced her to sports and athletic activities, something which her older sisters had shown much less of an interest in. As a result of this, the bond between Jody and Maurice was extremely strong, and the two often spent a great deal of time together. It was on the golf course, though, where Jody and her father would connect the most. While Maurice taught Jody how to swing a club, they would talk about life, hopes, and dreams. In a way, the golf course became their own private world, where they could share everything, and the relationship between father and daughter was galvanized on the fresh-cut green and the rolling landscapes. It wasn't all about sports for Jody, though. Her prime interest from a young age was television, and she dreamed of being broadcast around the country. Jody's love for television and film drew her into theater, where she would frequently pursue the larger roles, with dreams of celebrity in her young eyes. Joanne would later say of Jody's aspirations, quote, "Jody always knew she wanted to go into television from little on. She just loved to be on the stage. She was the one that wanted the big roles in the plays." End quote. This wasn't unusual for Jody, as she was known to pursue every venture in her life with the same drive and determination that would come to be key characteristics of her life later. She wasn't prone to letting go of ambition, and instead would double down on her efforts in hopes of achieving all that she dreamed. Sadly, when Jody was just 13 years old, a family tragedy would disrupt the flow and lead her into a world of confusion and self-doubt. In 1982, Jody's father Maurice lost a long battle with colon cancer. Jody was absolutely devastated by the loss of not only her father, but her best friend and confidant. Maurice had been his daughter's biggest cheerleader, and now, without him, there was almost a sense of not knowing what to do next. She would usually turn to him for advice, but he was no longer there. And stepping out onto the golf course, at first, was just too painful for her to confront. Joanne would later remark, quote, "It was very hard on everybody, and hard on Jody, because he suffered from colon cancer, and she was very close to him, because she was like the boy he never had." End quote. At this time, Jody's best friend Amy witnessed some changes in her behavior, but they were short-lived, and Jody's typical tenacity would ultimately win out. Her positive mindset and intense focus would guide her through the darkness of this time, and Amy would later say, quote, "It was a very profound loss. She had a rough summer after her dad died. I remember she lost a lot of weight and was very, very thin. But she kind of was the type of person not to really dwell and never be, oh, woe is me." End quote. After her struggle to come to terms with the loss of her father, Jody reinvested her efforts and began stepping back out onto the green, finding a sense of peace and comfort on the golf course, almost as if her father was there with her. It was through golf that she ultimately managed to overcome her pain and find a sense of purpose and drive. But to Joanne, she believed that golf represented something more to Jody. It was almost as if, through golf, she felt she could commune with her father, and she strove to show him all that she could do with what he had taught her. This mindset would spill over into all aspects of her life, from academics to personal achievements. And for Jody, it was all about doing the best she could do and pushing herself beyond what she thought she was capable of. Joanne would later say, quote, "She just applied herself 110% to everything she did, and I think she wanted her dad to be proud of her. I think that was part of what drove her." End quote. Jody would continue playing golf as she aged, and would join her high school golf team. She was reported to have been an excellent player, and her team won the state Class A tournaments in her junior and senior years of 1985 and 86, during which time Jody played a vital role. Throughout high school, she obtained good grades, and it was during this time that she started to develop an interest in a career in television more so than Hollywood. And as her dreams of acting began to change, they were replaced with a growing fascination with the news. She began to look at the possibilities of pursuing a job working for a television news station. Upon her graduation from high school in 1986, Jody would move on to St. Cloud State University. St. Cloud, Minnesota is located along the Mississippi River and is one of the largest schools in the Minnesota State College system. It boasts a revolving population of nearly 150,000 students and offers more than 200 majors, minors, and pre-professional programs throughout six colleges and schools. The city of St. Cloud offered Jody a wider view of the world, with its population being over 20 times that of Long Prairie at over 65,000 residents, making it Minnesota's 10th largest city. According to friends and family, it was Jody's time in St. Cloud that seemed to truly open her eyes to the possibility of traveling. A passion to see the world, which had already germinated within her, was in full bloom as she attended classes. Jody's pursuits at St. Cloud were in the fields of mass communications and speech communication, and after 4 years away, she graduated with a bachelor's degree in 1990. While everyone expected Jody to immediately leap into her passion for the news and to begin making attempts at getting on board at a local station, the free-spirited and passionate 22-year-old had other ideas in mind. Jody had plans for her future, and while the news and broadcasting were always part of the picture, she knew that life could often throw you curveballs, and before she made the choice to lock herself into any specific direction, she wanted to see a bit more of the world. She'd always dreamed of moving away from Long Prairie, of being in a larger city with a more vibrant life, and she saw this as her opportunity to do so. And so her first job post-college was working as a flight attendant for Northwest Airlines. Her childhood friend Amy would later say, quote, "I think she felt like, I want to see more of the world before I settle down and get into a career and maybe find a relationship and end up, you know, more tied down." So she did a lot of seeing the world from that time when she was a flight attendant. End quote. Jody loved being on the move and living her life in a different place from day to day. Her warm and sociable personality made her exceptional at this particular job, where she got to speak to different people every day and watch the world spin from the windows of a plane. While this was an exciting time in her life, Jody never viewed it as her future, and she knew that being a flight attendant was just a way to make a living while living out her dream of experiencing the world. It wasn't too long before the traveling bug was worked out of her system, and Jody began to set her sights back on her one true dream, broadcast journalism. This would take Jody out of Minnesota and to Iowa for the first time. Her first job in the industry was for KGAN, a local news channel located in Cedar Rapids. Jody worked as the bureau chief. Despite her lack of experience in the field, Jody was trusted with coordinating the efforts of reporters to investigate and cover stories. While this got her foot in the door and showed her skill and talent, this position placed her in the background, and Jody still held out dreams of being in front of the camera. Her second job in the field brought her back to Minnesota, where she was hired on to KSAX in Alexandria. Alexandria was larger than Long Prairie, though not by a great deal, but was certainly much smaller than Cedar Rapids. Her choice to take this position simply involved her desire to move closer to the positions she sought, and each new job suited her with new challenges and chances to prove herself. Displaying her typical hard work and diligence, Jody quickly earned the respect and admiration of her fellow co-workers. One thing, which remained consistent throughout Jody's moves and jobs, was her ability to develop strong friendships. Newsrooms can be stressful places to work. Everything moves so rapidly, and the stories can be all-encompassing. This often breeds a competitive environment. But for Jody, everyone was a part of the team, and she had no issues establishing strong connections that would last throughout her life. Finally, after spending some time learning all there was and mastering it at KSAX, Jody was offered a job which she considered a big break for her career. KIMT, located in Mason City, Iowa, had an open position for a morning and afternoon producer. While this was an exciting move for Jody, it was the other caveat to this position which drew her in. This producer would also function as an anchor on the morning and news broadcasts. After years working both behind and in front of the camera, though the latter was less so than the former, Jody finally had the opportunity to sit at the desk and guide the program. About this new job, Joanne would later say, quote, "She thought it was a promotion, that she was going to be moving up the ladder gradually, and she was really excited," end quote. The position required Jody to report in at 3 a.m., where she would put stories together, do research, make adjustments, and then she'd settle into the chair for the 6 a.m. and noon broadcasts. Mason City, Iowa, is not exactly the burgeoning metropolis that Jody dreamed of, with a population of just under 30,000. But to her, it was an opportunity and another chance to get a leg up. She dreamed of anchoring the news, and KIMT offered her this chance. She saw it as another challenge, but also a platform from which she might be able to make a case for herself to become an on-air broadcaster for a larger network sometime in the future. KIMT was a CBS affiliate, and one who was always driven to do her best. Jody believed that if she worked hard and knocked it out of the park, she might just catch the eye of one of the bigger show's producers. While it wasn't a guarantee, Jody knew she was going to give it her best either way. Jody rented an apartment from the Key Apartments, located on North Kentucky Avenue on the outskirts of Mason City. This placed her less than a 20-minute drive to her new job and provided her with enough distance to be able to settle down and unwind after a long day. Her shifts typically found her working from 3 a.m. until 12 or 1 p.m., which, while it was early for her to get up and required her to cut out a bit of her nightlife activities, didn't seem to bother her much. Joanne would later say, quote, "She didn't really complain about the morning shift at all. She had her afternoons, and she just enjoyed being on television," end quote. Outside of her career pursuits, Jody found her life in Mason City to be fun and exciting. She developed a close circle of friends with whom she would frequent local bars, while also finding ways to satisfy her urges to travel and perform in athletic activities. She still golfed, and would play with friends and also alone as a way to clear her head. She was known to enjoy skiing and was even known to go to Iowa City for water skiing. Jody's love life was one area which seemed to have a noticeable vacancy. By 1994, Jody was 26 years old, and her beauty was easily noticed and drew men towards her. The blonde-haired, brown-eyed girl had a captivating smile and an undeniable charm. Jody knew how to talk to a man, and this often served her well when trying to get information from someone for a story, but it also served a different purpose. According to some friends, during their college days, when money was tight and they still wanted to have fun, it wasn't uncommon for them to go out to local bars and use their flirtation to get free drinks. Jody didn't have to work very hard to beguile a man, but she'd yet to find one who truly captured her attention, though the 27-year-old wasn't worried. Her career was beginning to surge, and she assumed there would be plenty of time for that later. It was during this time with KIMT that Jody began to show the first signs of possible burnout from a life marked by hard-driving determination and constant movements. She made friends quickly at the station, but some noted that Jody would sometimes seem as though she were completely exhausted, and then she would burst out in total excitement and energy. Perhaps it was her ventures out to the bar with friends, or her struggle to adjust to the early morning schedule, but Jody developed a reputation for being late. Another producer at KIMT, Amy Coons, functioned as Jody's assistant at that time. In a later interview, when asked about Jody's punctuality, Coons responded, quote, "She was often late, about once a week. I would call her and wake her up, and she'd be into work within 20 minutes, end quote. It was during this time that quiet whispers began to circulate about the possibility of drug use. Jody was known to show erratic energy patterns, and when asked about this, Coons responded, quote, "Jody had been really up and down before her disappearance. She would fall asleep in edit bays, and later in the day would be really perky. I wondered what was going on with her. I would not be surprised if drugs were involved. End quote. When asked about Jody's behavior at work, Kuhn stated, quote, she was very demanding. She would often snap at me. Then she would turn around, clap, stand up at her desk and proclaim, I love life. I could never figure her out. End quote. Among those in Jody's social circle was a man with a lot of money to throw around and, allegedly, a predilection for boasting and drawing attention to himself. Arthur John Van Sice, who typically went by his middle name, was 49 years old when he met and began hanging around Jody. At the time, he worked as a district sales manager for Pfister Hybrid Seed Company. Mason City Detective Terence Prashaka, when asked about Van Sice, described him as, quote, very well known, but he's also active in his personal life. He liked to be out at bars at night. He liked to be somewhat of a show-off, maybe a playboy type. He had a very fancy boat for that time. End quote. Van Sice had met Jody when he moved into the Key Apartments upon first arriving in Mason City in the fall of 1994. According to friends, it wasn't uncommon for Jody and Van Sice to flirt and dance together, but it was abundantly clear that Jody's interests were no more than playful and platonic. It's been debated whether or not Van Sice had designs on Jody, but the general consensus is that, at least in terms of Jody, she said that was never going to happen. Van Sice seemed to fill a role in her life, that missing father figure that she still longed for. But even according to Jody's own diary, there was not the possibility of anything even resembling an intimate relationship there. Van Sice maintains that he never had an interest in Jody in that way, and that they were simply good friends, and he viewed her like a daughter. It wasn't uncommon for Van Sice to be around Jody and her friends. He was slowly accepted into the group, and Jody spoke about him, not as an individual, but as part of that group of friends in general. Half a year after meeting, Jody's 27th birthday was approaching, and Van Sice made the decision to organize a surprise party at a local bar. Jody was gleefully shocked by the gesture and had a great time that night, dancing with friends, drinking, and perhaps even flirting a little. At the party, a camera was present to record the events of the evening, and the tape will later play a role in Van Sice's accounts of the events leading up to Jody's disappearance. On the weekend of June 23rd and 25th, 1995, Jody had gone out of town to Iowa City for a fun weekend and water skiing. On Monday, June 26th, Jody participated in a local golf tournament. According to the official timeline, Jody left the tournament at approximately 8 p.m. Her comings and goings are tracked by telephone calls, one of which was placed from her apartment that evening at 8:24 p.m. Jody called her friend, Kelly Torgerson, but her husband answered. Kelly wasn't home at the time, so Jody spoke to the husband for a while. According to the husband, Jody was in high spirits when she got off the call. She requested that he let Kelly know she'd called and to give her a call back when she got in. Detective Prashaka, when asked about the call, said that, according to Kelly's husband, quote, there was nothing in her voice that she was scared or mentioned any problems with anybody recently. She actually made a long conversation about the trip she'd had, her skiing trip. She was actually more or less bragging to him about how much fun she'd had. End quote. It should be noted that Jody reported to work at 3 a.m., meaning that her work arrival time was a mere 7 hours after she arrived home after 8 p.m. that night. The 8:24 p.m. phone call, even if only lasting 5 minutes, would leave her with only 6 hours and 10 minutes to get ready for bed, sleep, then wake up, do her morning routine, and drive the 20 minutes to work. Though later evenings weren't exactly uncommon for Jody, This may have played a role in her tendency to be late for work. The following morning, on Tuesday, June 27th, Jody's arrival time of 3 a.m. came and went without her arriving. Being that it wasn't uncommon for Jody to be late, Amy Coons doesn't think a great deal about it and assumes that Jody will arrive before 4 a.m. When 4 a.m. comes, and Jody still hasn't shown up, Amy finds it necessary to make a call to her apartment, a call which she has made multiple times in the past. At approximately 4:10 a.m., Coons calls, and the phone rings and rings. At this point, she feels her assumption that Jody overslept is most likely the outcome of this situation. Eventually, Jody answers, and Coons can hear the sleepiness in her voice. She explains that it's now after 4 a.m., and she's overslept again. Jody is reported to have apologized and tells Coons that she'll be there in 20 minutes. It should be noted that some articles report that Coons had another employee place this call, but this seems to be due to confusion about a later call that takes place. And in an interview, Coons confirms her call stating, quote, "I don't remember what time I called her. I think it was 4:10 a.m. end quote. She goes on saying, quote, "She asked what time it was. I told her. She said she'd be right in," end quote. Thinking nothing more of the situation, Coons goes back to work preparing for that morning's broadcast. As time ticks by, 4:30 passes, and then 5. Coons assumes that Jody may have fallen back to sleep, but as the 6 a.m. hour approaches and the show is going to have to begin, Coons decides to sit in for Jody and anchor the episode herself. While Coons is on the air reporting that day's news, she can't help the growing concern in her mind. While Jody is frequently late, she's never this late, and she's never missed an episode of the program. Coons attempts another call to Jody, but this time, the phone never stops ringing. When asked about why she didn't call the police right then, Coons responded, quote, "I waited because I thought she had just fallen back asleep. At the very worst, maybe she fell and hit her head in the shower. And honestly, I was busy doing the work of two people," end quote. When the broadcast ends, Coons approaches an employee and asks him to call the police and see if they're able to go and do a welfare check at Jody's apartment. The call comes in to the Mason City Police Department at 7:15 a.m. Within 10 minutes, an officer arrives at the Key Apartments, and in the distance, he sees Jody's red Mazda Miata. He approaches her door and knocks several times, calling out her name and asking if everything is all right. He receives no answer. Being that there's nothing immediately alarming about the call, the officer decides to check out Jody's vehicle, assuming that she may have experienced car trouble and caught a ride with someone else. As soon as he gets near the vehicle, all semblance of this being a routine situation goes out the window. The vehicle itself doesn't appear damaged, but scattered all around are Jody's belongings. Among the items discovered are a pair of red women's dress shoes, a blow dryer, a bottle of hairspray, car keys, one of which is bent, and earrings. The car itself is not damaged, though its front driver's side mirror is folded forward. Detective Prashaka later says, quote, "It was actually folded in the outward position, which would make it appear that someone had brushed up against it and folded it in the outward position," end quote. The bent key draws attention as it's immediately assumed that this likely happened during a struggle, and considering the items scattered around, it becomes quickly clear that this is a crime scene and there's likely been an abduction. One detail which solidifies this in investigators' minds is when they discover drag marks in the silt nearby. Investigators are called to the scene and begin a multi-pronged approach. While the vehicle and area around it is being processed, other investigators enter the apartment while uniformed police begin canvassing the area, knocking on neighbors' doors, and asking if they witnessed or heard anything peculiar from the night or early morning hours. Multiple tenants report hearing screams at approximately 4:30 a.m., though none had called the police to report the sounds. According to Detective Prashaka, the complex had a lot of tenants, and there was a campground nearby, so hearing screaming or loud sounds in the early morning hours wasn't all that uncommon. That being said, no one reported hearing any vehicles or other voices. One witness, a man living in the complex, will later tell investigators that, as he was leaving for work that morning, around 4:30 a.m., he did note a light-colored van sitting in the lot with its parking lights on. Other officers are conducting a search of the apartment complex and surrounding area. That morning, they examined the park next to the complex, as well as the area around the Winnebago River, which runs behind the complex, though they find nothing of note. Back in Jody's apartment, nothing seems to be out of place, and there's no sign of a struggle. The more they look around, the less they believe anything related to the disappearance happened within the apartment. At one point, while in Jody's bedroom, they discover a journal on her bedside table. They go through it, hoping that there may be something which gives them a possible suspect or direction to look. But ultimately, there's little information considered helpful. The journal is later described as being short entries, including, but not limited to, Jody's future plans, her thoughts about her job, and her dreams of moving on to a larger television market and anchoring to a larger audience. Ultimately, the journal is taken into evidence, and no copies or statements are shared with the public. Mason City Police Lieutenant Frank Stearns is one of the investigators surveying the apartment when he notes something that isn't exactly unusual, but does pique his interest. In the bathroom, he finds the toilet seat in the upward position, suggesting the possibility that a male had been in the apartment recently. Despite this possibility, they find nothing else which suggests the presence of a man, though what exactly would suggest that is highly debatable, unless the man would have left something specific behind. Regardless, this detail is noted in their reports, and it's at this time that Stearns has to confront the reality of the situation. He places a call to Jody's sister, Joanne, who at first thinks that Jody may have been involved in an accident. When she's told that Jody is missing, she calms down a little, thinking that it might all be a mistake. She later says, quote, "He said Jody is missing. Missing? Well, I was kind of uplifted. Missing? You'll find her, you know. Then he said, we've been searching and we can't find her at all, and there's stuff by her car." End quote. While Joanne begins the drive to Mason City to find out exactly what's going on and where her sister is, detectives move from her apartment to the car. At this point, word has begun to travel around Mason City, and they find many of the complex residents gathering in the parking lot, watching their activities. Local media grabs a hold of the story, and due to their rush to catch the scoop, multiple inaccurate reports are disseminated to the public. According to early news reports, among the items found at the car, blood evidence was also gathered. The Mason City Police, though, dispute this claim, stating emphatically that no blood was found at the scene. An unidentified palm print was lifted from the vehicle, but that is the only piece of evidence publicly reported. It's at this point that detectives have a very odd encounter with one of Jody's friends, John Van Sice. According to investigators, Van Sice approached them in the parking lot and openly stated that he was the last person to see Jody alive. They find this statement troubling for, as far as they knew, they're dealing with a missing person and not necessarily a murder. So Van Sice's use of past tense when speaking about Jody makes them suspicious. According to Van Sice, Jody had been to his apartment the night before to watch the video shot at her surprise birthday party. Officers take a statement from him and let him know that they'll be speaking to him again during the course of their investigation. At the same time, they've begun checking with local newspaper companies to find out if any used a light-colored van, which may explain away the sighting in the parking lot that morning, but none are found which would have been at the Key apartment complex at that time. For investigators, the case is complicated by Jody's public status. Living in such a small town and being on television, she's essentially a local celebrity. As they question friends and family, they begin to piece together strange incidents which Jody experienced in the weeks and months leading up to her disappearance. According to police reports filed months earlier, Jody had been out jogging when a black truck began slowly driving behind her. Worried and concerned, she turned off her path and ran up to the front door of a home, and the driver continued on down the road. Jody reported this to police, who initially looked into it, but were unable to locate the vehicle or the driver. When Joanne was asked about this incident, she stated, quote, "Jody was worried a few times about stalking. A guy in a black truck had followed her and acted very creepy," end quote. Jody's childhood friend Amy went further, explaining that she and Jody had discussed her desire for self-defense and to be able to protect herself. According to Amy, quote, "She had talked to me at length about how she had taken a self-defense class. She didn't feel safe, and she wanted to be able to defend herself," end quote. Armed with this new information, Mason City Police begin running checks on all the owners of black trucks in the area who have any kind of criminal background. They're unable to locate anyone that results in any possible connection to Jody, the apartment complex, or being in the area that morning. By the next day, June 28th, agents from the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, as well as the FBI, join in with local officials in their search. Police Chief Jack Schleiper speaks to the media, informing them that at this time, they're dealing with a missing persons case and foul play is suspected. But unfortunately, they are in possession of few clues or pieces of evidence which may give them a direction to go. Searches continue, but yield no results. And as the days begin passing, the possibility of an abduction becomes solidified in the minds of investigators. By July 1st, 4 days after Jody vanished, it's officially announced that the disappearance is being treated as an abduction, and the tip about the light-colored van being seen in the parking lot is released to the public. A reward fund is established for tips and information and reaches $11,000. It's around this time that John Van Sice speaks to the media, and investigators find his statement strange enough to take a closer look. In his statement, Van Sice says, quote, "She just makes me feel so good and so great about things. That's just Jody. You can't help but love that woman. You can't help but love Jody," end quote. Investigators speak to Van Sice again, and again he tells the same story, saying that Jody came over to his place a little after 8 p.m. to watch the video, but this sets off alarms for investigators. According to their timeline, Jody left the golf event at 8 p.m. and made a phone call from her own apartment at 8:24 p.m. They can't help but wonder whether Jody ever did go to Van Sice's apartment that night. Having learned about the birthday party, investigators speak to multiple friends and co-workers who had been present. They speak of the evening being very pleasant and fun, and multiple attendees report that Jody had danced with Van Sice several times that night. According to their statements, Jody danced with multiple people and treated Van Sice no different than anyone else, but they felt that Van Sice had kept his eyes on her through the night and seemed much more invested in maintaining her attention. When Van Sice is asked about where he was between the hours of 4 and 5 a.m. the morning Jody disappeared, he tells investigators that he was at home, had woken up around 5 a.m., and had taken a morning walk. Investigators found Van Cise's accounting of events and his behavior troubling, but at that time, they didn't have any evidence which would afford them the ability to get warrants to search his home or property. Instead, they ask Van Cise if he's willing to take a polygraph, and he agrees to do so. Van Cise later says that he went to Cedar Falls, Iowa to take the polygraph and alleges that he passed with, quote, flying colors. Though Mason City Police have never publicly commented on the results of this polygraph. When asked about the test, Van Cise later states, quote, I was offended at first, but now I understand. I'm glad I did this because it proves I had nothing to do with it, end quote. On July 2nd, Police Chief Schleiper speaks to the media and once again refers to the van, stating, quote, I want to emphasize that the person or persons associated with the van are not necessarily suspects. They simply may have information that would help us in our investigation, end quote. Schleiper goes on to answer questions, stating that they're unsure if Jody's public persona and fame plays any role in her disappearance. He explains that more than 200 people have been interviewed and goes on to say, quote, over the next few days, we'll be expanding our search area and expanding the number of people assisting with the investigation, end quote. While investigators are searching areas surrounding the complex with an ever-expanding radius, they employ helicopters to also search an area southwest of the city. The Mason City Fire Department and State Department of Natural Resources are thoroughly searching the Winnebago River, though nothing is ultimately found. Nearly 300 tips are phoned into the police within the first week of the investigation. Days begin passing, with nothing new discovered. By July 7th, ground and air searches for Jody are called off, though the interview process continues. On July 10th, Chief Schleiper states that an FBI behavioral scientist is attempting to determine if there's a link between Jody's disappearance and any other disappearances in the area. He also explains that they have received, at this point, more than 700 tips. Joanne is questioned by police for any information she may have about her sister's disappearance. But the more Joanne meets and speaks with Jody's friends, the more she realizes that her kid sister had much more of a life than she was aware of, and she is of little help. She eventually returns to Minnesota, feeling that she can't be of much assistance, though she does maintain contact with the Mason City Police. July slowly fades, and then August begins to pass with few, if any, leads. Over the course of the next month, Chief Schleiper continues speaking to the media and reveals several pieces of information. On August 3rd, the chief explains that they still have found no leads or suspects. On August 12th, John Lang, a special agent with the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, tells the media that it appears that the suspect was likely watching Jody and noted her behavior patterns. Back at the offices of KIMT, employees are shocked by the lack of development in the case, though they put Jody down on leave and refused to hire a replacement anchor. On August 27th, a candlelight vigil is held for Jody at a public pool area, while local businesses display yellow ribbons and signs carrying the message, Find Jody. In early September, the reward for information about Jody's disappearance grows to $30,000, but no one is supplying information that leads to any new discoveries. Jody's family takes it upon themselves to hire a private investigation firm, McCarthy & Associates, to examine the case. They bring in private investigator Doug Jassa from Nebraska. Through the firm, the family is put in touch with three prominent psychics who allege to be able to assist with the case. The meeting is ultimately televised on the show Psychic Detectives. According to the so-called psychics, Jody's abductor was someone who saw her on TV and had become obsessed with her. The private investigation firm is unable to come up with anything to identify a suspect. By the end of the month, Jody's story is blasted into the national consciousness when America's Most Wanted airs a segment on it, which results in more than 60 tips, though none appear to reveal anything which can assist investigators. Days begin turning into weeks, and weeks into months. By the six-month anniversary of Jody's disappearance, in December of 1995, police are unable to announce any leads or suspects. They reveal that they have searched areas near two Mason City dams, but turned up nothing significant. KIMT continues to hold Jody's position, with other staff members filling in for her, and the reward offered reaches $34,000. In February of 1996, Jody's case is featured on the television series Unsolved Mysteries, and Chief Schleiper later reveals that the segment resulted in 186 phone calls and 97 tips for investigators, though none of these will pan out. Several months pass, and for Jody's family, their frustration and sadness over her disappearance is mounting. They wonder how she could simply vanish without a trace, and nothing can be found. And in hopes of contributing something to the effort, 100 volunteers are gathered to conduct a search in the northeast Cerro Gordo countryside. Volunteers are given flags to mark anything they spot which appears suspicious, and then these flags are examined by law enforcement officials. Sadly, nothing is found during this search which may reveal anything about the case. The search is conducted in May of 1996, and just 1 month later, the one-year anniversary of Jody's disappearance comes around, and investigators are frustrated that they have no new information. They're essentially working with the same details they've had since day one, and while they can't connect anyone to the disappearance, they are aware that someone knows something that they aren't sharing. Soon, the months begin transforming into years, and from 1996 to 1999, there is little information about Jody's case or the status of the investigation revealed to the public. While investigators assure the media that the case is very much open and ongoing, public interest begins to wane, and over the next years, Jody's name begins to fade from the spotlight. The mystery of her disappearance only deepens. And then, in the winter of 1999, the first new piece of information is brought to the attention of investigators. Anthony Jackson, a prison inmate serving a life sentence for the rapes of three women in 1997, writes a rap song. It's alleged that one part of the song refers to a dead body in the Iowa city of Tipton, and it is suggested that the song is about Jody. Investigators look into Jackson and discover that, at the time Jody vanished, he was living in Mason City. This certainly piques their interest, and so they begin to dig deeper. Law enforcement officials in Tipton are contacted and brought into the investigation, and the first new search in over 3 years is launched. Investigators employ cadaver dogs, and they search areas in Tipton which are most likely locations for concealing a body. One dog gets a hit, but ultimately nothing is found. Mason City police arrange to speak with Jackson, but he denies any involvement in the crime or that any rap song he may or may not have come up with has anything to do with Jody Huzentrout. Lieutenant Frank Stearns, when asked about Jackson, states, quote, "We ran that out as far as we could, but it's our belief that he had nothing to do with it," end quote. When asked about Jackson, Joanne responds, quote, "For a while there, we were really convinced maybe it was him, that we had a prime suspect, but the police in Mason City didn't think so. But he had a girlfriend that looked so much like Jody, and he'd broken up with her," end quote. For the time being, Jackson is dismissed as a suspect, though his name will resurface later in the investigation. Three more long and bitter years will pass, and then in the summer of 2002, some 7 years after Jody mysteriously vanished from the parking lot of her apartment complex, two men will decide to examine the case themselves, and ultimately find themselves pulled into a world of possible corruption, murder, and cover-up. News director Gary Peterson of KAAL-TV in Austin, Minnesota, receives a letter from a psychic. The psychic explains that he's willing to do a reading or analysis of a cold case for free. Peterson had always been fascinated by Jody's case, and figured he had nothing to lose by doing so. A picture of Jody was sent out, and later, another letter was received. The letter contained questions and answers that the psychic alleged had to do with Jody's case. After speaking with Josh Benson, a news anchor for KAAL, the two men decide to run a 13-part special about Jody's disappearance in hopes of drawing in new attention. The audience responds, and interest in Jody's disappearance is reinvigorated, and throughout the course of their research into the case, both Peterson and Benson become fixated on figuring out what happened. They begin to examine it in more detail, and map out their own links as to what may have occurred. For them, one area of interest is the bizarre death of a man named Billy Pruin. Pruin was a Mason City local, and a friend of Jody's. Pruin was described by many as a fun-loving, kind man who got along easily with everyone. According to official records, on Sunday, April 2nd, 1995, Pruin proposed to his then-girlfriend, Gretchen Tussler. 2 days later, on Tuesday, April 4th, Pruin took his truck to Mason City to pick up a new tractor he had just purchased for in the price range of approximately $200,000. He picked up the tractor and then drove it home, leaving his truck behind. Though multiple calls were placed to Pruin that evening, he failed to answer his phone. On Wednesday, April 5th, a friend went to check on Pruin after several unanswered calls. He found the front door hanging 4 inches open and Pruin's keys still in the lock to the door. He's reported to have shouted for Pruin, but seeing his truck wasn't there and hearing no response nor commotion inside the home, the man chose to leave the property, never having entered. The next morning, on April 6th, Pruin's mother went to the home to check on her son, whom she hadn't heard from. At this time, she entered the home and found Pruin deceased in the dining room. Investigators immediately arrived on the scene and found Pruin with a gunshot wound in his chest and the expended slug of his own .44 Magnum laying on the floor in the kitchen, and his revolver was in his hand. Initially, this death was ruled as a suicide, though many doubted this possibility. Pruin was reported to have been in high spirits, had gotten engaged days earlier, and had just made a major purchase for his farm. There were also details about the death which baffled those who looked into it, such as the fact that Billy's chest wound was larger than the wound in his back, suggesting that the shot which killed him had actually been fired from behind him, making it that his chest wound was an exit wound. For many, they believed that Billy had been murdered, and among those supporters of this theory was Jody Huzentrout. Ultimately, Pruin's cause of death was changed to that of undetermined, and to this day, it remains unknown what exactly transpired that day. Other details which raised suspicions were the fact that no identifiable prints were lifted from Pruin's revolver, and Pruin's fiance stated that, in the weeks leading up to his death, he had confessed to her that he was afraid of something, though he never specified what. In what would appear to be a very strange choice of behaviors, Pruin was noted to have recently acquired a large life insurance policy. According to that policy, several months had to pass, during which time, if Pruin were to commit suicide, his policy would be void. This is a fairly standard clause, but in Pruin's case, His death occurred just weeks before that time period would have ended, leading many to believe that even if Pruin had committed suicide, he wouldn't have done so until after that time had elapsed. Jody, as well as many others, believed that Pruin had been attacked by someone and that his keys being left in the door suggested he had rushed into the home to get his gun, at which point someone may have engaged him in a struggle and shot him. Gunshot residue was not found on Pruin's hands, nor on his clothing, which for many indicates that Pruin was not close to the gun when fired, and they believe that he may have come home and been ambushed by someone who had already gained entry and grabbed his revolver. In an interesting twist, when the state medical examiner, located in Des Moines, Iowa, was contacted about Pruin's death, he stated that he hadn't yet received the official autopsy report from Cerro Gordo County. This report is typically mailed within days of the autopsy being completed. For whatever reason, it took 11 years for this report to reach the state medical examiner. Pruin's case remains unsolved. According to Jody's friends and her sister Joanne, she never believed that the truth about this situation had come out, and she'd expressed an interest in examining it herself. Whether or not she dug into it, how much she discovered, if anything at all, and whether or not the circumstances surrounding Pruin's death played a role in her disappearance just 3 months later, remains unknown. It's a point of speculation for many, but is a hot-button issue in regard to Jody's disappearance. In what some believe may be a connection to Pruin's death, Jody's friend, Kelly Torgerson, whom she had called the night before she vanished, reported that on the day Jody disappeared, she received a letter from her. In the letter, Jody is alleged to have stated she was concerned for her safety and that she may be being stalked. For Peterson and Benson, their investigation into Jody's disappearance continued. They came upon a bizarre story told by an officer of the court who had a disturbing experience back in 1996, just 1 year after Jody vanished. While speaking with a convicted sex offender, the court officer happened to mention Mason City. The sex offender had a two-word response: Jody Huzentrout. When the court officer dug further and stated that she wasn't sure that Huzentrout was still alive, the man grimly responded, "No, she's dead." That's gonna do it for part one of the abduction of Jody Huzentrout. In part two, I'll dig deeper into the story of this sex offender, accusations of corruption within the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, as well as allegations from a former Mason City police officer that investigators working Jody's case may have been involved in her disappearance, and an incendiary statement from an Iowa state representative who accuses Mason City officials of a cover-up in Jody's case. Beyond that, we'll conclude the current timeline of the investigation and examine the theories revolving around this baffling and disturbing case. If you'd like to discuss this case or any others, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Tweet me at traceevpod. Follow me on Instagram at traceevidencepod, or join the Facebook group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate and review the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever app you're using. For more information about other cases, transcripts, media, and more, please visit our website at trace-evidence.com. I'm going to leave you with a promo from one of my favorite podcasts, True Crime Fan Club, which just happens to be hosted by one of the nicest and most talented podcast hosts out there, who I had the pleasure of meeting at CrimeCon. Thank you for listening to this episode of Trace Evidence, and I hope you'll join me next week for the conclusion to my look into the abduction of Jody Huzentrout.
Hi, I'm Lainey, host of the True Crime Fan Club podcast. If you're a true crime addict like I am, then my show is for you. I'll peel back the curtain and give you a glimpse into the life and crimes of some of the most demented minds. Check out the episode Broken Bonds and listen to a brother reveal a deeply held secret. Or hear about the day that the heavy metal community will never forget in the episode Dimebag. These episodes are just a sample of our catalog, so you have plenty to binge. Just search for True Crime Fan Club Podcast and any podcatcher. You won't want to miss an episode.